KALW.
And then when my mom put my, she gave me water, right? And then when she put my inhaler on, I couldn't breathe, so she called 911.
How can we protect vulnerable residents from the growing threat of wildfire smoke?
But that can be harder for low-income families who maybe live in substandard rental housing where the smoke really comes inside because there's, you know, leaky windows or doors.
Today, how to bring cleaner air to those with lower incomes. Then, how the idea of wilderness became an experience that wasn't being sold to everyone.
The National Park Service was advertising itself nationally, colorful posters, and they intentionally did not circulate those to African American communities.
It's the next episode of How Wild. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Bay Area residents are no strangers to living under a heavy blanket of wildfire smoke. But what should we do when it happens, and how do we make sure everyone can afford the solution? The Bay Area Air Quality Management District is trying to answer that question. It's the first air district in the country to pioneer a new program, one that protects vulnerable residents from the growing threat of wildfire smoke. Reporter Kayla Mihalovich has the story.
Bear, wake up. Up, up.
This is Rosalie Lopez. She's 6 years old with curly brown hair that's tied back by a pink bow. She's giving me a tour of her apartment in downtown San Francisco. And she starts by introducing me to her hamster, Paco.
Wake up. It's daytime already. Come on, wake up. Did I run away and try to bit you? Hey, come here. Stop.
After I meet Paco, Rosalie takes me to her room where colorful string lights hang across the walls and stuffed animals crowd the shelves above her bed.
Oh, I have these. Look, come here.
She shows me her Legos.
I don't have wheels like this, but I do have wheels for this, but not for this one.
And then she pulls out a small box from under her desk.
You want to see what's in my mystery box? All right, fine.
She calls it her mystery box because you need a key to open it.
It would kind of be a little bit bad to do this. Look, oops, sorry.
Okay. Oh. It's where she keeps her important things.
Play-Doh and my inhaler.
Her emergency inhaler. That's because Rosalie has asthma. Her mom, Sharon, said she first noticed something was wrong when Rosalie started walking.
She will start coughing and she would get like easily tired when she was running. So I knew something was going on, but I wasn't sure what it was.
2 years ago, Rosalie woke up in the middle of the night. She couldn't stop coughing.
And then when my mom put my, she gave me water, right? And then when she put my inhaler on, I couldn't breathe, so she called 911.
At the hospital, Rosalie's doctors prescribed a daily inhaler in addition to her emergency one. But they also said making changes at home was part of her treatment.
The first thing that arrived was an air purifier.
It was delivered to Rosalie and Sharon through the Air District's Home Air Filtration Program, a $700,000 effort to bring cleaner air to low-income people. The program was funded through the Air District's General Fund in 2021. It was a response to the growing number of terrible wildfires.
As a mother, I know I was very concerned about the health of my children.
That's Ann Kelsey Lamb, Director of Regional Asthma Management and Prevention.
And as the director of an asthma program, it made me think about all of the mothers of children with asthma and how truly terrifying these wildfire smoke events must be.
So she was thrilled when the Air District approached her organization to help distribute air purifiers. Now, Anne coordinates between the Air District and on-the-ground organizations who get the air purifiers into people's homes.
We do see and hear a lot about the immediate health impacts on people with asthma.
Anne and other public health experts say that the long-term health impacts of exposure to wildfire smoke haven't been thoroughly studied.
the scientific research continues to evolve and what other types of health impacts there are in addition to respiratory impacts.
Anne says what early research does show is that it's crucial to try to reduce exposure to smoke.
But that can be harder for low-income families who maybe live in substandard rental housing where the smoke really comes inside because there's leaky windows or doors.
But air purifiers have proven to be effective at reducing particulate matter.
So the air that the people inside the home are breathing is cleaner.
Plus, purifiers are a relatively inexpensive way to combat a problem with limited solutions. Anne says the Bay Area's program can serve as a model for others to follow. And it has. Air districts across the state, including in Santa Barbara and the Mojave Desert, were inspired to create their own pilot programs. And as wildfires have spread across the country,
I received calls from asthma programs in those states saying, what are we supposed to do to help our families with asthma during these times? We've never had to deal with this. And we had a lot of information to share with them.
Is it this thing? Come on, Kimmy.
After putting away her mystery box, Rosalie takes me to the room at the end of the hallway where she sleeps next to her mom every night.
Is it this thing?
The air purifier, about the size of a carton of milk, sits on top of a small black table in the corner of the room. A blue light glows at the top.
It looks almost like a tube. There's white on top, and there's letters. What color is the letters?
They keep it running 24/7. Sharon tells me, with this air purifier from the program, a new vacuum and medications, Rosalie's asthma has improved. She used to miss a lot of school, but now she's able to do all of her daily activities.
You probably don't think it's going to work and it's not doing what it's supposed to do, but it definitely does its work. You can feel it. You can tell.
Rosalie tugs at her mom's shirt, exasperated.
Yeah, because you're kind of talking too much.
So Rosalie and Sharon show me just how effective the air purifier is.
That makes sense, Mommy? Let me just spray some perfume, and it'll definitely turn on by itself.
Okay.
Or just somewhere around here.
It smells so good.
I know.
After a minute,
Oh
my God!
Rosalie says it's effective in another way.
In case if someone farts, it just takes it out. It just glows red when someone farts, like my mom sometimes and my grandma. Me too. I just sometimes have a stinky one. All right.
Since it started in 2021, the Home Air Filtration Program has distributed close to 3,000 air purifiers to low-income people in the Bay Area. That includes about 900 kids with asthma. It's a start. But there are roughly 27,000 low-income kids living with asthma in the Bay Area, and funding is running out. The Air District says they're looking into ways to secure more money, which could come from state agencies, private funders, the federal government, or their own reserves, so the program can live on and serve more residents like Rosalie. In San Francisco, I'm Kayla Mihalovich for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Kayla. You can find all our coverage on the impact of wildfire smoke and health at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Up next, we'll continue exploring the concept of capital W wilderness with an excerpt from the third episode of our new podcast, How Wild. The series is reported, produced, and hosted by KALW's very own Marissa Ortega Welch. In this episode, we're taking a break from hiking to go indoors to understand our relationship to the great outdoors. Marissa takes us to an art museum to consider how the work of artists like Ansel Adams and thinkers like John Muir shaped Americans' ideas of what authentic nature should look like and who belongs in it.
So the picture we're looking at now, Monolith, the Face of Half Dome.
I'm at the De Young Museum in San Francisco, looking at a striking black and white photo of a giant granite mountain.
I think it's kind of one of the most iconic pictures of Yosemite.
Sarah McKay, who at the time was an assistant curator, is giving me a tour of this exhibit about the work of Ansel Adams, famous for his photos of Western landscapes.
Even if you don't know who he is, you've probably seen a poster of his work in a college dorm room or gotten a postcard. And across the gallery, we have a picture called Clearing Winter Storm.
Oh my gosh, gorgeous.
Yes.
It's this moody picture of Yosemite Valley as the clouds part to reveal the giant monolith El Capitan on one side and Bridal Veil Falls on the other.
And this is what Adams would have called one of his Mona Lisas.
Ansel Adams started taking photos of Yosemite and other places in the Sierra starting in the 19-teens. He followed in the footsteps of the first generation of landscape photographers, documenting the West as it was being settled.
It was really about trying to capture in a picture and share with a lot of people, especially, you know, armchair tourists, people on the East Coast who couldn't go to the West or who hadn't, why these places were so special.
And by doing so, he was shaping how people saw nature. McKay leads me over to a massive photo in the next room by another photographer, Alvarado Morel.
This picture is of El Capitan and Bridal Veil, almost the exact same point where Ansel Adams took his photograph.
Alvarado Morel is a contemporary photographer, but he draws on old school techniques like a tent camera. A periscope on top of the tent casts the view onto the ground below, and he takes a photo of that. So you see the same image of Yosemite Valley with El Capitan and the waterfall projected onto grainy concrete. Alvarado Morel's photo playfully reveals what Ansel Adams' photo is not showing us.
Adams is actually taking this photograph from a parking lot, I believe on top of his car.
He had a station wagon with a special platform on top where he could stand to take his photos.
And he very purposefully makes it seem that he is caught in this beautiful moment in the wild in this picture, which he does in so many of his other photographs. But I think this picture in particular, once you understand the context, you realize how actively he was maintaining an image of the West in some of his photographs.
Maintaining an image of the West without humans in it. McKay says Ansel Adams would erase the human traces from a photo, either by framing them out or getting rid of them in the darkroom.
There's another one over here that's probably a good example of that, too.
It's another photo of Yosemite Valley taken from up high, and there's a little bit of what looks like smoke running through the bottom of the valley.
Or mist, or maybe a river, you can't really tell, but it was a road. And so he's changing the image when he's developing it to make it seem as if it isn't peopled and it's not being built.
At this point, the National Park System was still in its early stages. Ansel Adams was trying to promote these places to Americans to rally support for their protection. And his photos became iconic. He essentially created an image of what authentic nature looked like as a place with no people in it. And photographers have been trying to replicate that since.
And I think, yeah, a lot of people still do the same thing. When you go to Yosemite or National Park, you want the picture that seems like you're trapped in the wilderness with no one around. So I get it. But yeah, this is kind of one of the places this was born.
What do you picture when you hear the word wilderness? I don't mean capital W designated wilderness, like we've been talking about from the Wilderness Act, but wilderness as a concept. I'm just going to speak for myself here. To me, it's an environment with no people, with no obvious traces of humans. No buildings or roads or dams. It's quiet, except for bird songs or creek running. And usually it's grand, epic, a particular type of nature. I don't picture a prairie or a wetland when I picture wilderness. I picture something more like an Ansel Adams photo. A giant mountain, a wide river curving through a steep, dramatic canyon. But these images in my head, my expectations of wilderness and what I think of as authentic nature, they're shaped by my culture, my background. That's true for all of us. I asked my friend Shireen, who grew up in Egypt, what she pictures when she thinks of wilderness, and she said the Sahara. I grew up in San Diego, The few times we went camping as a kid involved taking our minivan to the beach. My first time in wilderness was on a school trip in the 7th grade to Yosemite, so that's what I picture. The idea of wilderness itself is a cultural construct, if you're willing to get academic with me. And I wanted to know how this concept of wilderness came to be, which is why, in this episode, we're taking a break from hiking to ponder how nature got framed. This is How Wild, a podcast about wilderness, how it's changing, and what that says about us as humans. Episode 3, Natural. The thing is, Ansel Adams and other photographers, their advertising, it worked. It drew people to the national parks by selling them on an idea of nature that didn't quite exist. There was a reality lurking just out of frame. Here's our trusty historian Phoebe Young, the author of Camping Grounds, a book about the history of camping in the U.S.
Ansel Adams would have seen in Yosemite car campers kind of parked cheek by jowl in these big open areas and just kind of laying waste to meadows because there was no regulation about where people could or could not camp.
Somehow that image sounds less postcard worthy. Ansel Adams' decision to leave people out of the frame was following a tradition of landscape painters who tried to show that America had beauty that could rival Europe.
We might not have the cathedrals, we might not have the ancient European civilization history, but, you know, by God, we had Half Dome. We had the Rocky Mountains.
The concept of wilderness in America came from Europe, where in pre-modern times it was seen as a dangerous space, a void.
You know, a howling wilderness was often what this was called. It wasn't, people didn't generally seek out wilderness.
In part because of the Bible, Europeans saw themselves as being separate from and above plants and animals. And they brought that mindset to the Americas, which to them was entirely wilderness. They saw it as undeveloped, but also with an abundance of natural resources. Forests for timber, animals to hunt, metals to mine.
So the Americas was seen as both this kind of slightly scary but fantastic opportunity to take a space of complete wilderness and make it over in the way that you want it.
As the U.S. developed, cities took over. Wilderness got scarcer, and it changed from something to be afraid of to something to be revered. Some early converts were the Puritans, who came to view the woods as the Bible incarnate,
where they could read the Book of God in its original form.
Then with the Transcendentalists, people like Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson, who wrote about nature as a place to become more connected to God.
And to restore what had been lost in the kind of rush to commerce and urbanization in the Northeast.
Resorts popped up in places like the White Mountains of New Hampshire, where people went to spend their time walking, painting, writing in nature. This, of course, required time and money. So while in theory these experiences were prescribed to everyone,
in practice, this became something that only elite folk could do, and those folk were by and large white.
Meanwhile, over on the West Coast, a man named John Muir was tromping around. He walked from the Bay Area to Yosemite, a trip that I only drive, and he camped in the Sierra, summiting mountains by himself with just a blanket and some bread in his pocket. My point is that he was like the ultimate adventure mountain man, right? But Phoebe says he actually looked down on people who lived on the land. You can see it in his writing about indigenous people who he observed collecting wild foods, and about freed African Americans in the South who he saw camping out on the open road after the Civil War.
To have to kind of scrabble, as he might say, for a living on the land was not as kind of civilized as he imagined himself to be.
Which is interesting because it was John Muir's writings, his idea of authentic nature as a place you went out to, not something you lived on and with, that got sold to Americans to promote the idea of the national parks. John Muir's writings and activism spurred the U.S. government to establish the first ones. By the 1920s, by the time Ansel Adams was taking photos, the national parks and forests were seeing that onslaught of tourists, and land managers were getting worried about the impacts to the land.
And it was, in fact, in places like Yosemite or other California parks, like Sequoia National Park in particular, they noticed that some of the trees were dying.
Turns out, tourists driving and camping wherever they wanted in forests and meadows was not great for the environment. While land managers like Alda Leopold began advocating for wilderness areas with no roads, others tried to find a more car-friendly solution. And that's where the Loop Campground was born.
What we now think of as the quintessential campground, the Loop Campground, where you have a designated individual site with a singular driveway and a one-way loop road.
The thing is, this onslaught of tourists, it was by and large white people, because this idea of an authentic nature experience was not being sold to everyone.
The National Park Service was advertising itself nationally, colorful posters, ads in magazines and newspapers, and they intentionally did not circulate those to African-American communities.
This is pre-Civil Rights Act. Officially, the national parks were not racially segregated, but unofficially, absolutely. The essentially all-white leadership was incredibly uncomfortable with the idea of Black people coming to the parks, and especially how that might upset the white workers and tourists.
And so they decided to embark on an unofficial policy of essentially discouragement, of letting African-American communities know that there were really no services for them.
And there weren't.
Many of the accommodations in, say, gateway towns outside of national parks barred African-Americans from staying in those hotels. Many African-Americans did not necessarily feel comfortable camping out in the open where they could be subject to surveillance and worse from local law enforcement.
For mostly white middle-class people, though, as cars became less expensive and freeways developed, car camping became a relatively affordable way for a family to vacation. So much so that by the 60s, there were newspaper articles being written about overcrowding in national parks and forests. Sound familiar? The problem even made the cover of one of the country's most famous magazines.
So this is a fold-out, double-size cover of Time magazine, illustrated in a kind of, you know, cartoonish fashion.
It's giving Where's Waldo Goes to the Wilderness. The backdrop is a natural landscape with mountains and lakes and waterfalls.
That is just absolutely filled to the brim with cars, trailers, tents, canoes, people everywhere.
Everywhere you look, you see a new detail.
People fighting with bears, fighting with each other, all the way up to the top of the mountains where there are antennas and a kind of frowning cloud looking out over the scene of almost chaos in a way.
Phoebe says the magazine cover really captured the feeling people were having at the time.
Feeling so crowded and almost so urban-like, right? That they'd no longer felt like natural open space of what they kind of came there to escape the city, that they, in a sense, brought this little city of chaos with them.
The car campground was no longer the refuge from the city that some people wanted, and it was no longer the nature experience people were seeking.
That form of camping, that form of experiencing the outdoors, had become overdeveloped. And therefore, inauthentic, right? There's something fakey about it. You weren't really experiencing real nature.
Younger people, especially, were craving something else.
To go out beyond where there are so many people, to experience more of a sense of authentic wilderness.
That was an excerpt from the third episode of How Wild, a series produced by KLW's Marissa Ortega Welch, made with support from California Humanities, and distributed as a podcast by NPR. We'll be airing excerpts here on Cross Currents Tuesdays, but you can find a link to the entire series at klw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Arun Nair, Zen Iqbal, Hussein Khan, James Rowlands, Ghana Dijo Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.